We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
And the dignity of humanity. Lyndon Johnson was talking way back then, so he meant humanity. Of course he did. It has to do with, you know, do we have choices? Can we choose such simple things as what we eat? Do we not have a right, a real right to know what the heck we are eating? Well, some people don't think we should know. Food and democracy. One doesn't usually link those two words, but as you'll see from today's discussion, the two are quite closely linked. Democracy is about citizens having a choice and showing some power over our own lives. But there's a bill moving very quickly down in Washington in Congress right now, HB 1599, House Bill 1599, which aims to assault democracy and our right to know what we are eating in our foods. It's been called the mother of all Monsanto Protection Acts. And it's a classic power struggle between plutocracy on one side and those demanding democracy on the other. Our guest on this first half of Keeping Democracy Alive is Catherine Paul, National Director of Organic Consumers Association. Tell us about the intent of this bill, please.
I'm happy to do that. Thanks for having me on the show. H.R. 1599 has been called, or they call it, the writers of the bill call it, the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act, and it's anything but that.
Oh,
this bill was clearly intended to do one thing, and that is to prevent food manufacturers from ever having to tell consumers in the U.S. if the food that they are selling you is either genetically engineered or contains genetically modified ingredients. That's the intent of the bill. That's the original intent of the bill. However, it's gone through several versions, and it's now much worse than just that.
Well, how did it get started? My understanding is, and I want to find out how it's gotten worse, I believe a law in Vermont requiring the labeling. Is that what triggered it all?
Well, that certainly is why it's being rushed through Congress now. Because the Vermont law would have to be enacted July 1st, 2016, which means beginning about October of this year, those food manufacturers would have to start the process of changing their labels. And that's why there's such a push right now to pass this law in Congress to preempt Vermont's law. But it actually started sooner than that when citizen ballot initiatives in California and Washington State and Oregon showed that there was great consumer demand for labeling and forced the food manufacturers and the biotech companies to spend millions and millions of dollars trying to defeat these laws.
Well, they have the millions of dollars. It's a great deal of profit at stake, no question about it. Most people probably do know what GMOs are, genetically modified organisms. Perhaps briefly you can tell us what they're used for and how they may affect neighboring crops, neighboring organic crops in particular. And Monsanto's role in there as well.
Sure. genetically modified foods, you know, the industry loves to misrepresent this and tell us, well, you know, this has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. It's not true. It's very different from hybridization. It occurs in a lab, and it's manipulation of DNA and genetic material. And we don't really know what the long-term consequences of that is, either for the foods and our health or the environment, and the potential for contaminating the crops that are grown by farmers who don't want to grow GMO crops, whether they're conventional or organic.
Right.
We've had instances of those crops being contaminated widely by GMO crops. Because you can't contain seeds once they're out there.
Yeah, the wind.
the wind blows. I mean, you can't. And that brings me to one of the ways in which this law is now much worse that they're trying to put.
Okay, yeah.
It would overturn laws that have been passed in counties in California and Oregon that some of these counties have passed laws saying that they've created GMO-free zones, essentially saying you can't plant GMO crops here because the risk of contamination to our non-GMO and organic farmers is too great. This law would overturn that. It would make it impossible at the state or local level to pass any law that would create a GMO-free zone.
That is truly amazing. I mean, you talk about assaults on democracy. Just to have plutocratic rule, you know, ruled by the incredibly powerful few. And Monsanto, are they they're like the bad guy in all this, right? I mean, what's your sense? You've been listening. You've been around the biotech industry for a long time, Catherine Paul. Are a lot of the talking points coming from the industry that you hear coming out of members of Congress? You know, you hear this. Is it like they've cut and pasted it coming out of members of Congress now?
That's exactly right. It's pretty much the same line all the time. They love to say that there's, you know, scientific consensus that GMO foods are safe. And that's absolutely untrue. We have hundreds of scientists all over the world saying that they've published a paper saying there is no consensus in the scientific community that these are safe. So that's a flat-out lie. They love to put this out there saying, oh, it's going to cost manufacturers a lot of money and they're going to have to pass that down to consumers. Study after study has shown that that's ridiculous. These companies change their labels all the time. There's no cost involved to do this. Certainly, for the millions that they've spent to defeat these laws, they could have changed their labels many times. Mm. It's a ridiculous argument. They just want to keep that information away from consumers.
Now, they argue, I believe, I may be wrong, that GMOs can help deal with world starvation. They can help make food more available. What is the selling point of GMOs? And I also, in Europe, I believe they've taken pretty stringent steps to prevent GMOs and control it, yes?
They have, but we're trying to undermine that through the trade deal.
Of course. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, right.
Yep. All of those trade deals are designed to break down those barriers. They call them barriers to trade, mm-hmm. laws that other countries have enacted. And keep in mind, again, we say this all the time, 64 countries in the world require these labels on foods. It's only here in the U.S. that they've been able to, by our political system, to keep the labels off of the food. It's really quite amazing. As for the argument feeding the world, it's an absolutely ridiculous argument. GMO corn and GMO soy are not feeding the hungry. We've had these GMO soy and GMO cotton and GMO corn crops for decades. we still have world hunger. We're not feeding the world with these crops. We're feeding animals in factory farms, and we're making tons of ethanol fuel, but we're not feeding the world.
So why is Monsanto so, you know, out front? And I presume they are they the only makers of GMOs? They seem to be the big bully on the block here.
Well, they've sort of become the face, you know, the target. Certainly Dow with its Agent Orange crops,
yes. Mm-hmm.
as we call them, is a big player in this industry, DuPont. And then, of course, they're all in bed with the big food manufacturers who have figured out that this is, you know, these are cheap ingredients, and that's why you have them all working together to prevent this.
We are talking on Keeping Democracy Alive about GMOs and some current moves in Congress to freeze out the people and to put in the control of the big ag companies. And, you know, if big ag really believes that GMOs are totally safe, then playing a devil's advocate here, wouldn't labeling whether or not GMOs are in a particular food give the message to the consumer, oh, be wary, GMOs are not safe? They must, if they think they're totally safe, why would they want to label it? Because people could be, frankly, afraid of something that they would argue they shouldn't be afraid of.
Well, I would argue that I can pick up any number of packaged foods in the grocery store and read a long list of ingredients that are scary to me, words I can't even pronounce, but
right.
we require those to be on there. We require, or at least allow, salmon, for instance, to be, you can say it's in the grocery store, you pick up a package, it's either farmed or wild.
Right.
Are we to, that's just so you can distinguish. We ought to, but when GMO salmon is approved, which the FDA will likely approve it, you'll have no way to know if you're buying GMO salmon. You can still only distinguish between farmed and wild. We label all sorts of things. It's information. And the fact is that there is such a correlation between pesticide residue in your food and GMOs that alone is information that people should be allowed to have.
Tell us more about that. That's interesting, yeah.
I mean, GMOs, over 84%, for instance, are grown with massive amounts of glyphosate, which the World Health Organization in March came out and said is a probable human carcinogen.
Mm.
You can't ingest GMO corn or GMO corn-derived products or GMO soy, which is in everything, without also ingesting glyphosate.
Mm.
And now the World Health Organization tells us that this is a probable carcinogen. And so the only way for me to know if I'm ingesting a product that contains corn, if it's also been grown with glyphosate, is if it's labeled GMO.
Boy, and I'll tell you, whenever I buy milk, one company started it up. Thankfully, other companies have started it, that they label it carefully. They say, our farmers have pledged not to use any GMO products. And that's what I buy, you know, and I wonder if House Bill 1599 passes, if somehow that would be made illegal too. Tell us what's going on with that now in Congress. It's before the Agriculture Committee, and where are we in the process of this law, which again would, if I have it right, would make it so that there can be no labeling of GMOs, period.
They've adjusted the law now in one of its versions up until last week, they would have completely prevented any food manufacturer from ever saying their product was non-GMO unless it was certified non-GMO by a government-run program that they have yet to create.
Mm.
They had to adjust that. They're now going to allow the non-GMO project. So they've made some adjustment in that because it was so over-the-top outrageous. But the bill right now, we we understood, and in fact, I had a conversation with the staff of Shelley Pingree's, Congresswoman Pingree's office the other day, and they're still surprised by this. It was originally supposed to be voted on in the Agriculture Committee, which it was this week, and then in the Energy and Commerce Committee. Now they're saying they're going to skip the Energy and Commerce Committee vote and take it straight to the House for a floor vote, probably on Thursday.
Wow. So that's coming up really quickly. Another fast-track piece of legislation that they don't want us to know about. Now, how profitable is it? I mean, I can't imagine, I don't know if you have any figures as to how much they've been paying their lobbyist, Monsanto and the other guys. Why is it so important to them that they have these GMOs? Is it that much of a profit driver? I guess it must be.
It is. It's clearly been a huge profit driver for Monsanto. You know, the reason... They love to say that they've created this, you know, these crops to feed the world, and they love to claim that they're sustainable, which is ridiculous. But the fact of the matter is that they created these crops for one purpose, and that is to be able to sell massive amounts of chemicals. Monsanto was in the chemical business long before it was in the agriculture business.
Yeah.
Same with Dow, which was making, you know, the Agent Orange that we used in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
These companies originated as poison companies, manufacturers of poison.
Mm-hmm.
And when they ran out of markets for that, they got into the agriculture business and figured out that if they got farmers to commit to growing their genetically modified corn or soy or alfalfa or whatever, those farmers then would have to use these massive amounts of chemicals.
Right.
And that's where the profit is.
Right. They have to use it. They are, it's like dealing heroin. They're addicted to it. Their crops need it. They depend on it.
It's not even working anymore because just as scientists predicted, these crops are evolving to be resistant, and so then we have to up the ante, right? We have to make more powerful chemicals because the original ones don't work anymore.
And even, I understand, the production of the chemicals used to make GMOs is concerning to the environment. Is that correct?
I don't think there's anything about this technology and this type of agriculture that shouldn't be of concern. Whether you're concerned about your own health, whether you're concerned about the environment, I mean, we're totally destroying the soil quality. So, you know, lousy soil grows nutrient-poor food. It isn't even nutritious anymore.
Right.
We're contaminating waterways. We had, you know, this city of Toledo having to shut down the city's water a year or so ago because it was so contaminated from runoff from agriculture industry.
Wow.
There isn't anything that shouldn't be of concern. And you know, even if you're not a health nut, and if you're not an environmentalist, this law should concern everyone. Historically, states have had this right. And isn't it interesting that we now have 83 Republican co-sponsors for this bill?
Wow.
Republicans who claim to be so pro-states' rights.
Right.
Turns out they're only pro-states' rights when it suits them. We're looking at taking away rights that states have had for 200 years.
Wow. That is so interesting. The hypocrisy there is amazing. Who are some of the bad guys in the House of Representatives, and how does it look in the Senate?
Well, you know, it was Representative Mike Pompeo from Kansas who introduced this, and his buddy there, the ranking member of the Agriculture Committee, Connolly, and I'm so sorry I've forgotten his first name, has signed on. I mean, there's a long list. There's three of them. And you can look and see that many of these people are getting campaign contributions.
What a surprise!
They get. So, again, as you said, they are spending millions and millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars lobbying on this.
They're
very determined to pass it.
Are there good folks that are reliable, that are standing up to all that pressure, that are fighting against it?
Well, yeah, a prime example, again, is from my state, Representative Shelley Pingree, who's done an amazing job of standing up and speaking out against this bill.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks as though it will pass the House next week. I don't think anybody believes anymore that it won't. So we're waiting for a Senate companion bill. It hasn't been introduced yet. There's been talk about it. But the bigger fear is that they will slip this in as a rider at the last minute, when it comes time to government shutdown over budget,
mm-hmm.
riders and amendments get attached and thrown in here and there. Our biggest fear is that they're going to try to slip it in somewhere.
I can just imagine that. And, I can't imagine the president or, I don't know, maybe some of the candidates. We're here. This show is coming from New Hampshire, where we have a lot of say over the presidential candidates. We can be asking them about it. And again, playing devil's advocate here, in the 1950s, there was this big fear of fluoridation. There's some fear now about GMOs. The fear of fluoridation, I think, was shown to be not really accurate. It does help teeth quite a bit. There are fears in large doses of fluoridation on neural development, I believe. But do they claim that it is scientifically proven that genetically modified organisms are safe? Do they claim that?
Oh, yes, they do claim that. And again, there are plenty of scientists around the world who will say that that's absolutely not true, and there have been plenty of studies that have raised a lot of questions, but the industry always, of course, attacks those scientists and attacks their studies. They have a tremendous public relations movement out there that have managed to do a great job of getting their message out through the corporate media. You know, I always recommend this book. It's only been out a couple of months, but if anybody wants to understand the history of how these were allowed into our food system without adequate safety testing and the extent to which Monsanto and other companies really stacked the deck in their favor very early on, I highly recommend people read a book called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth by Stephen Drucker. It traces the entire history with, an in-depth documentation. There's nothing speculative about this book.
Mm-hmm.
And it outlines exactly what happened and why these got into the food system without proper safety testing in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, why the industry is so desperate to protect it.
Well, interesting. It now that you mention it, it seems to me it's part of a whole big movement by some of the crazier right-wingers, although the whole Republican Party seems to be filled with them these days, to do away with all government relations. So that there, I mean, even food inspection, which came about, as a result of that book, The Jungle, just do away with that. Have no food inspection and just leave it up to the big manufacturers. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, our guest today is Catherine Paul, National Director of Organic Consumers Association. We're talking about House Bill 1599 requiring that people be kept in the dark about GMOs. Now, I was encouraged. Pope Francis recently said something about GMOs, didn't he? What did he say?
Yes, he did, and he talked about the fact he was very careful not to declare them either safe or not safe, but he said this whole industrial system of agriculture really isn't working. It's not working for farmers all over the world. It's not working for the health of our soil and our planet and the health of our population. He was very critical of it, because it's a form of agriculture that's destructive on almost any level you can imagine. When it comes to human health, when it comes to the environment, when it comes to local economies, when it comes to farmers themselves, and certainly, as we've seen in this country, when it comes to democracy.
Really, really. Democracy is just barely hanging by a thread, and it's under assault all the time. What can concerned people do? We're not powerless here. What are some actions that listeners can take?
Well, you know, first and foremost, look for products that, and the only way we know 100% now that a product isn't GMO is to buy certified organic.
Right. Well, what about this bill? What can people do to stop this bill, House Bill 1599?
Continue to call, and phone calls are much more effective than emails. Continue to call members of Congress, post on their Facebook, that sort of public conversation on their Facebook pages makes a difference. We have to continue to let as many members of Congress know that, look, we don't want this. This isn't right. It's not right from a state's rights perspective. It's not right from a consumer rights perspective. This is siding with big corporations over public interest. And lawmakers need to hear that from as many people as possible. And we're going to continue this week to hammer on members of the House, whether or not we think it may pass. The numbers matter. You know, the more support it has, the worse it's going to go in the Senate.
Right.
And then we will be working diligently when it comes time to fight this bill in the Senate, assuming they don't sneak it through some other way.
And if people want to get in touch with you as it goes along, because it is so true that if the members of Congress in the House and Senate don't hear from people, they think people don't care. But if they do hear from people, it absolutely makes a difference. It doesn't always win the day, but it definitely makes a difference. How can people keep on top of the websites you can point them to, how they can keep in touch with the Organic Consumers Association? What are your suggestions?
Well, we've been featuring this heavily because our history over the past 4 years or so has been to be working on these state ballot initiatives, and we were very involved in passing the law in Vermont. At this point, it makes no sense to try to pass another state law if we're going to let them pass this federal law that would preempt them. So we, while it's not our only focus, it is really at our top priority right now. So we have a newsletter, a weekly newsletter. It goes out every Thursday. You can go to our website and sign up for that.
And what's your website?
It's organicconsumers.org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We can perhaps stop this and once again fight to keep our democracy. Catherine Paul, National Director, Organic Consumers Association, thank you so much for shedding some light into this dark matter.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Here's Neil Young to talk about Monsanto.
Well, you better change your station, 'cause that ain't all that we got. Yeah, I want a cup of coffee, but I don't want a GMO. I like to start my day off without helping Monsanto.
Oh,
Neil Young from his new album, The Monsanto Years. Yeah, he calls him Monsanto. He's from Canada. Well, we're going to switch gears a bit to talk about the new deal with Iran. When it comes to the deal worked out and preventing Iran from developing nuclear weapons, it seems that Republicans in Congress have all become Marxists. What? Marxist? I'm not talking about Karl Marx. I'm talking, of course, about Groucho Marx. They are Groucho Marxists, and I will play a little something here in his role as Quincy Wagstaff in the movie Horse Feathers. The members of Republican members of Congress are doing just this.
I don't know what they have to say. It makes no difference anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it. No matter what it is or who commenced it, I'm against it. Your proposition may be good, but let's have one thing understood. Whatever it is, I'm against it. And even when you've changed it or condensed it, I'm against it.
Yes, they're against it. Doesn't matter what it is. If Obama's for it, if it may possibly be a feather in his cap, doesn't matter what it is, even if it benefits the world tremendously, they're against it. The fact is, according to the deal, Iran agrees that under no circumstances will it ever seek, develop, or acquire any nuclear weapons, but it retains the right to peaceful nuclear energy under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Well, this is big news, this treaty with Iran. Our guest on this segment is Mitchell Plitnik, Program Director at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Mitchell, thanks for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Well, Mitchell, his writing has appeared in the Jordan Times, Middle East Report, San Francisco Chronicle, and other outlets. He was columnist for Tikkun Magazine, Zeek Magazine, and Souciant. I don't know those last two. He has spoken all over the country on Middle East politics and has regularly offered commentary on a wide range of radio and television outlets, including PBS NewsHour, The O'Reilly Factor, that must have been fun, and CNBC Asia. What are the Republicans in Congress saying about this deal? And do you think they really believe what they're saying?
Well, I mean, in a sense, I think they believe what they're saying because they're criticizing the fact that it basically leaves Iran with a nuclear infrastructure. But we knew that was going to happen. So I think they're essentially saying that they really don't want any deal with Iran. And I think you're right about the reason. The reason is because, not because it's in any way a risk for American security, but because they don't want Obama to have a very, very significant foreign policy victory.
Yes, for sure. And what about the concern? I mean, nobody wants Iran to have nuclear weapons. What about the concern that the opponents say, you can't trust Iran? They're still designated as a state supporter of worldwide terrorism. What about that concern?
Well, that's why this deal is a good deal. It has nothing to do with trust. There's no trust here. There is an unprecedented level of monitoring that Iran has agreed to. That's going to last for the next, in some cases, some parts of it for 10 years, for 15 years, for 25 years. Also, on top of being, you know, having requirements under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran has also agreed to the additional protocol, which will mean higher level of monitoring forever. So, you know, is it perfect? Is it ideal? Probably not from the perspective of not wanting Iran to ever have any path to a nuclear weapon, but this is what diplomacy is. Iran has to have a reason to agree, and their reason to agree is that the rest of the world agrees that they're entitled to an energy producing peaceful nuclear program. So there's no real reason for concern on the basis of trust, because there's no trust being given here. No one's saying trust Iran. No one's saying believe them. What we're saying is the International Atomic Energy Agency, is going to be looking at everything Iran does at a level that they have never approached with any other country. I don't see how you can do better than that.
Well, skeptics are saying, again, you can't trust Iran. They're going to be able to hide this stuff. And I will say, before you get to that, probably about 10 years ago, I had someone on who had just returned from visiting Iran, and she was saying how much they very much wanted a new energy source, a nuclear energy source. Now, I personally don't like nuclear energy, but it's a far cry from a nuclear bomb. Back to the question, will they be able to hide it? You know, will they be able to have, okay, nuclear energy generating electricity by splitting atoms and be able to tuck away any ability to actually start making the processes of making nuclear weapons?
Well, the reality is, in order for them to do that, it would be very, very difficult. I can't say impossible. Nothing's impossible. I mean, there's always, you can always find a way to do almost anything you want. But the IAEA will be able to inspect all of Iran's nuclear sites all the time. That's going to be under constant monitoring. And if they suspect that there's anything clandestine going on at any other site, including military sites, they will be able to go and inspect those sites as well. Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, came on NBC and said, well, they'll have 24 days there's a 24-day period in which, if they want to inspect a military site, that has to go through a process, and if Iran doesn't immediately want to agree, then there's a commission that has to decide whether or not it's legitimate, and it would give them 24 days to hide whatever they were doing. But the fact of the matter is, you cannot hide enriching uranium past the acceptable point in the space of a month. It leaves traces that are indelible and that will last for months on end. The radioactive traces are things that the IAEA can detect. So if there's any suspicion that Iran is breaking its agreement, they're going to have the ability to detect that and to bring down the consequences, which would probably mean at least a snapback of U.S. sanctions, which are very significant. Is it impossible? No, but Iran would have to be very irrational to violate this agreement at this point, anywhere within the next 15 years. And both American and Israeli intelligence agree they are not irrational actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're much, much, much bigger than Iraq, for example, and very sophisticated people. And, it's different probably from what most Americans picture about Iran. And they certainly are a player in the area. And as you mentioned, Netanyahu is completely apoplectic about the deal. Is it a threat to Israel? And how powerful is Netanyahu in the U.S. Congress, do you think? Will this be a test of his strength over the U.S. Congress?
Well, I think that the first question is this a real threat to Israel? Look, the fact of the matter is, whatever risk is being taken here, we're not taking it here in the United States. It is Israel that would be at risk. So there, most Israelis, not just the right wing, not just the Likud party, not just Netanyahu, the overwhelming majority of Israelis are not in favor of this deal. And for understandable reasons, the risk is really theirs much more than ours. And they're not getting anything positive out of it as we are. So, or at least that's the perception in Israel, and I think it's an understandable one. Having said that, this, I believe, and I think the Obama administration, I know, believes, actually, that this is going to enhance Israel's security.
Yes.
By cutting off the path to an Iranian bomb. So that is where we start from. As I said before, I think the Republicans don't have to be pushed by Netanyahu. They're more than motivated enough just to stop Obama. On the Democratic side, there are clearly a few members of the Senate. Robert Menendez would be the best example. There might be a few others who are pretty much in line with the Republicans to begin with. And Netanyahu will certainly do everything he can to push Congress into the direction he wants. I personally do not think he's going to be successful, but there's going to be a battle. And the battle's going to be not among the Republicans. It's not going to be Republicans versus Democrats. It's going to be among Democrats. and how many of them can resist the pressure from some powerful lobbying groups here, not just AIPAC and groups that are pro-Israel, but also the neocon PACs, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, the American Enterprise Institute, and other groups that are going to be doing everything they can to kill this deal.
Interesting.
So there will be a battle. I don't think that in the end they're going to get enough Democrats to go against the president on something this big. And I think the deal will eventually survive. I think there'll probably be a vote against it, but when Obama vetoes, they will not be able to override it. So, again, I think Netanyahu has done Israel a great disservice, because one point Netanyahu and others in Israel are making is that Israel's concerns were not adequately addressed. And I think there's some truth to that, but the reason they were not adequately addressed is because Netanyahu basically made it an all-or-nothing proposition.
Yeah.
Said, you know, I don't want to see any deal. The sorts of things that he was demanding basically were things that were deal killers. There was no way Iran was ever going to agree to them. And as a result, Israel moved itself out of the conversation. So their concerns, however legitimate they might be, were not taken into account. They were cut off from early on. They started information to the press to paint the negotiations in a bad light, and that meant that they were getting less communication after that from the United States, because John Kerry and his team didn't want everything going into the media. So I think Netanyahu really did Israel a grave disservice here. I understand the concerns of many Israelis. I understand that they weren't addressed, maybe to their satisfaction, but that was because of the actions of their prime minister, not because United States doesn't care about.
If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, our guest on this segment is Mitchell Plitnik, Program Director at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. And I would think, you know, if this deal works, which I think it will, that Israel really should breathe a sigh of relief. I mean, it's not like they don't have other problems, but that would be one less from Iran. If Iran does not have nuclear weapons, I mean, gee, it might take the fun out of Israel bombing Iran, but aside from that, that'll be one less threat to worry about. Now, they keep stirring up other threats as well, Israel does, but now, the whole process here, Jim Webb, who just recently started running for president, said, quote, rather than an executive agreement, this should have been debated openly in front of the Congress, unquote. What's your reaction to that?
Well, that's just not the way things are worked out. The president's job is to conduct foreign policy. It is not Congress's job to conduct foreign policy. It is Congress's job to have some oversight of what the president does. And I think the process that's in place does that. If this was really a bad deal, if this was really something that left a lot of holes for Iran to pursue a nuclear weapon, Democrats in Congress would vote against it. I think that's just being responsible members of Congress, and I don't think that anybody in their right mind would allow any president to cut a deal like this that actually jeopardized American security. So the agreement does go to Congress. They get 60 days to look it over in all the detail, get all their staff members, you know, combing through it, finding, you know, every hole or any flaws that might be there, and then they get to decide yay or nay on the agreement. I think that's the way foreign policy is supposed to work. That's the president's job, is to work out these deals and then bring it before Congress to vote on them.
That's
so there's nothing special in that sense about the process that the Obama administration undertook here. They have kept Congress informed all along. There have been hearing after hearing, both public and private, with congressional leadership. So nothing's been done here in secret. And if there were really things that members of Congress could not vote for, could not stand with on a security basis, they would have already known about them, and I guarantee you they would have told every reporter they could find.
That's true.
But they don't exist.
you know, the State Department is part of the executive branch of government. It is not part of the legislative branch of government. It's worked like that for, oh, a couple hundred years or so. All kinds of treaties have been negotiated forever. And, you know, for some who obviously don't like Obama to say that this was done wrong, that it shouldn't have been done through the executive branch, they're just intentionally ignoring history, which is, hey, they have every right to do, and they do it pretty often. And you talk about history, a lot of Republicans have this pedestal, a very high pedestal on which they put Saint Ronald Reagan. What about his relations with Iran's leaders and thinking of deals like this?
Well, we of course, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners are old enough to remember the Iran-Contra scandal and how we dealt with that, not to mention the fact that at least it was said at the time when Reagan had won the election, but before he took office, that there were certain communications with Iran that made it clear that he wanted the hostages released right when he was becoming president,
right,
and that the Iranians agreed with that. Whether or not, I mean, as far as I know, that has never been proven, but certainly there was a lot of talk about that, and we know the Reagan administration dealt with Iran clandestinely.
Oh, yeah.
So we have that history. We know how the Republicans' cynical minds at that time at least worked, and I think the same cynicism is showing itself right now. The issue here is politics, and it is a particular agenda. Back in the 80s, it was advancing the anti-Marxist programs in Central America.
Right.
It was opposing the Sandinistas and supporting the Contras in Nicaragua. Now it's simply about making sure that Barack Obama does not have this kind of foreign policy victory. But they're going to fail because they don't have a case. When you look at the arguments against this deal, there's no case. Many of the talking points they put out are simply false. Some of them are true, but there's no alternative to them. And the bottom line is, nobody has any better ideas.
Right.
And if there was no deal, Iran would, if we believe that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapon, if there was no deal, Iran can have one by default. So, there's no options being presented, and it's simply about getting a Democratic president to look bad.
Yes.
And in so doing, they're jeopardizing the ability of future presidents to conduct negotiations.
And Iran is such a potentially big player in the Middle East. On one side, you have the Saudis, who, you know, theoretically are good buddies there, and they're not very nice to their people, that's for sure. The idea of beheading is not unknown, to put it mildly, in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's bitter enemies, I believe, are the Persians, the Iranians. And I wonder how this deal, you know, if it goes through, if it happens, how this deal might influence the future of the Middle East. And what, if anything, we've heard from the Saudis about this. They don't like the Iranians.
Well, the Saudis don't like the Iranians, but the Saudis have come out very clearly in support of the deal. They have their reservations, and they want to make sure that the United States is still going to be behind them. And I think the Obama administration has made it very clear that they will be. But they have concerns about it, but they've been very clear about supporting the deal. The Gulf states have unanimously approved the deal. They all like the fact that Iran is blocked from acquiring a nuclear weapon.
Sure.
So I think, those, you know, having said that, there are real concerns. But a lot of those concerns are overblown. It's the same for Israel's concerns. Most Israelis may recognize that, yes, the Iranians won't have a nuclear bomb, but they're afraid that their support, now that they have more money, for Hezbollah will skyrocket. The Saudis have the same concerns in Yemen and Iraq. But the reality is that the sort of support that Iran gives to those groups is not very expensive. They don't tend to fund them. What they tend to do is train them, help advise them, possibly help them acquire arms through third parties and things of that nature. So it doesn't more money doesn't really increase Iran's ability to help those groups, because that's just not the way they help them. And plus, they need the money at home. That's what this is all about. This is about quieting the Iranian people who are screaming for economic relief.
Sure.
And that it's about giving it to them. And if they fail to do that, I think you're going to see lots of unrest in Iran, and I don't think that's the regime's intention. I think they want to maintain their own stability, and the way for them to do that is to improve their economy. So that's where those funds are going to go. And I think that's going to mean it's a generally positive outcome. It isn't going to change the issues the Saudis have in Yemen with Iran,
right.
The issues the Bahrainis have, the issues the Israelis have. Those things are going to continue. I would contend, however, that now a door is open to try and resolve some of the issues in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon in a diplomatic way, now that there's communication that's possible with Iran, and because Iran has incentive to scale back some of their rhetoric, to scale back some of their activities, because they're going to be doing business with Europe, and they're going to want to keep the Europeans happy.
I think that is a huge point here that may really, I mean, okay, stopping them from getting nuclear weapons is a very, very big deal. But affecting the power arrangement that there is and bringing Iran in closer to the Western world, my goodness, that is a very good thing. I can't see how it cannot be a good thing for the people of Iran. And could it not be argued now that the sanctions, which have gone on for a very long time, that the sanctions worked?
The sanctions were part of a program. It was, you know, it was carrot and stick. I personally am of the belief that when both carrots have stick, it tends to be effective. Nice to just be able to use carrots, but that's probably not the world we live in. I think it was effective to the point. It was effective because there were sanctions and there was an alternative for Iran. If there was just sanctions, which is what Republicans are advocating, more sanctions could have gotten us a better deal. Well, no, because more sanctions don't change what the bottom line was for Iran. Without Iran being able to come back to their people, without the leadership being able to come back to their people with something that says, we're making some compromises, but look what we're getting, then there's no diplomacy. Both sides have to get something in order for diplomacy to work.
No question about it. And they got something here, and this will enable more people will be able to buy more stuff and improve the economy there and spread the wealth and just have less incentive for belligerence. They just will now, you know. And speaking of, well, you were about to say something.
Well, I was just going to say that there is less incentive for belligerence, and to the extent that people are still worried about their human rights record and their other activities in the region, there are still sanctions in place that are related to those things, and those are not touched by this agreement.
That's true. They can be dealt with.
Iran is now totally free.
Right. They can be dealt with in other manners, but this was not the time or place for that. This is a narrow focus thing. Well, there is the little problem in the area called ISIS, the Islamic State. I wonder how this new deal might actually influence the fight against ISIS. I mean, Iran's government doesn't like ISIS, and we have not been able to work.
Not at all.
So tell us how you think this deal will affect the fight against ISIS now. They can't be happy. ISIS can't be happy.
Well, I would preface it by saying the deal by itself, it's possible that the deal will simply close the path to an Iranian nuclear weapon, and that's all we ever get. And if that's the case, that's fine. But I do think it has the very real potential to expand, and it's precisely because of ISIS. It's because of the fact that the United States, as well as the Arab states, Israel and Iran have a common enemy, and a common enemy that's a much greater threat than Al-Qaeda was or the Taliban were. They're certainly have made more impressive gains than any of those groups. So I think it's very possible that having opened a negotiating door, plus the fact that there is a common enemy, will open more doors and will open up more possibilities for the United States and the Saudis and, you know, those one day even the Israelis to work with Iran against ISIS. I certainly, I'm not going to say that's going to happen.
Right.
I wouldn't make that bold a prediction, but it's certainly a possibility, and it's much more of a possibility now than it was before. And let's not forget, early on in the fight against the Taliban, the Iranians offered to work with the Bush administration. And so it wouldn't be unprecedented. And they did some. They did work together for a while to oppose the Taliban 10 years ago. So it would be unprecedented to see something like that happen.
And I can't help but think that, Iran has already been involved in the fight against ISIS. They do it from their side. We do it from ours. And, you know, there's a lot of, it's very complex, but ISIS has got to be a little bit more worried, which I think is a good thing.
I think so. Yeah. And I think that's a very strong positive, another strong positive that comes out of this deal.
Yeah. And this deal is not a guaranteed, you know, path to peace between, you know, in the area. It's been a hotbed area since a few hundred years. It's going to take active civil society groups in both countries, in all countries, to put the U.S. and Iran on a trajectory toward justice. I believe you said something like that. And what can people do now? We are, again, not powerless. We still have a little bit of a democracy left. What would you suggest people do to make sure this thing happens?
Well, I mean, the first step is very clear. Call your member of Congress, both the House and especially the Senate.
Yes.
And especially Democrats. Call them and tell them that you want this deal to go through. And tell your friends to do the same thing. I think one of the problems that we face with things like this is I'm told this by staffers on the Hill all the time, that they hear from the right, that the right wing, they're calling them, they're writing letters, they're setting up meetings. Do it. This is really important. This is,
yes.
This is a very, very big deal, and it could turn into a much bigger deal. So I think that's the first step. I do think we're going to win this fight.
Yes.
And so from there, it's going to be, you know, about trying to understand Iran better and encouraging further diplomacy with Iran. And so that needs to be on everyone's foreign policy agenda. Encourage further diplomacy, not trusting, not pretending
right.
Iran is a bunch of nice people,
right.
But talking with them is a good thing. And that needs to move forward to see where else we might be able to improve the situation and perhaps, you know, have the U.S., EU, and the United Nations play a positive role in trying to resolve conflicts in places like Yemen and Iraq and Syria in a peaceful manner rather than what we're doing right now.
And I happen to think this may portend even more progress, way more progress than Nixon's opening to China, because they're still a very repressive regime. So this may have more of an effect than that. If people want to contact you or go to Foundation for Middle East Peace, what's the website?
It's fmep.org. See what we have to say on a variety of subjects in the Middle East.
Thank you so much. Very informative and kind of hopeful. Nice to have every now and then. Thanks so much, Mitchell, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
There may be peace on earth. It's a start. It's a little start. Call your member of Congress and your senator. It really makes a difference. That's a way to keep democracy alive.
Turn on the news. The killing continues. And there before the grace of God. Fighting in the